Welcome back to Hour 2 of In the Moment. I'm Chris Loffrey. Lori Walsh is off today. Tim Shorn is the Director of International Studies and Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota. He's with us today to talk about Afghanistan, ISIS, North Korea, plenty of other things. Dr. Shorn, welcome back to In the Moment.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
There are a lot of things going on.
You know, there are no slow news days anymore, it seems.
There isn't. So let's start with Afghanistan. During President Trump's campaign, he called for a military withdrawal from Afghanistan, if you recall. After hearing his speech last week, what changed his mind?
Well, I think that's a good question, and it shows what happens when you move from being candidate to president, that all of a sudden now you own the problems that come across your desk. They're not somebody else's problems, and so you have to decide what has changed, what do I need to do differently now that I'm actually sitting in the Oval Office? And I think President Trump realized that, hey, it's just too difficult for a sitting president to be the man or the woman eventually to withdraw from a country, to pull out armed forces and to say either we're finished, we're leaving, we quit, or we're going to call this a victory and find a reason to exit. I think that's just too tough a call for most presidents to make.
There's been a lot of talk about, and hopefully I don't throw you off guard here, these black and white photos of Afghan women from the 70s. And what really is the significance of those photos, and why is it being talked about so heavily?
And you know, that's interesting, because in the 1970s, Afghanistan was very much a satellite Soviet state. Mm-hmm. And so what we saw was kind of an imposition of Soviet ideals, and even to some extent Western ideals then, on especially Kabul. Now, one of the things that we need to realize is that those photos represent kind of an idealization of what everybody wanted Afghanistan to turn into after 2001. We made the rash and incorrect assumption that Afghanistan had actually been that at one time. And while Kabul was a modern, you know, forward-focused city, you still had traditional Afghan ways operating in the country, in the, you know, out and about throughout Afghanistan. You still had the traditional leaders. You still had traditional societal roles. You still had religious leaders and religion playing a role, despite what the Soviets wanted to accomplish. And so I think what a lot of people wanted to see happen once the United States went into Afghanistan after 9/11 was that we wanted to create a Western-style, Western-focused democracy that would be liberal, that would be secular, and that wasn't going to happen. And so, you know, I think the idea probably behind President Trump's change of heart is that, oh, I've seen those pictures. This is what I want us to leave in Afghanistan when we finally withdraw. And that's not going to happen. What we need to think about is, you know, setting those pictures aside, given one, Afghan society, two, what we are willing to invest further into Afghanistan, what are we ultimately willing to accept when we prepare to withdraw our forces?
Now, this spark, if you will, didn't happen just yesterday. What I'm getting at is this is 16 years in the making now.
Right.
So why has this come to the surface now? Why the reason to amp this up now?
Right. And what we see is the Taliban regaining more of the territory that they had once held. Second, we're starting to see ISIS infiltrate Afghanistan. And this shouldn't be a surprise. And probably at some point when you and I have talked before, we've talked mm-hmm. about how fighting ISIS is really going to be like whack-a-mole. Going mm-hmm. to a carnival and you take that rubber mallet and you try to hit the mole out of whichever hole it's popping out of. We are misleading ourselves. We are lying to ourselves if we think eradicating ISIS from Iraq and then eventually Syria is actually going to sound the death knell for ISIS. What we're going to see instead is ISIS just scattering. And we already see that to some extent in places like Libya. My concern down the road would be Tunisia, certain parts of Central Asia, certainly in Europe. We're going to see ISIS people, some of them will fight to the death out of either commitment or they simply can't get out. But a lot of them are going to scatter to continue the revolution, to continue their ideology elsewhere. And so one of the places we've seen them go is Afghanistan on the edge of Central Asia. And we also know that they and the Taliban are oftentimes fighting over the same territory, fighting over the same hearts and minds. And ironically, we have now decided that ISIS is maybe more of a threat, more radical than the Taliban. And so what we're focusing on is the rise of the Taliban, the spread of ISIS, and really, to some extent, too, the failure of the Afghan state, the Afghan government that we helped put in place. We can add another level of I don't want to say complexity, kind of another level of a pain in the rear, and that is that the Russians are returning, and it appears that they are starting to support the Taliban. I guess that's a blowback and irony all wrapped into one. We supported the Taliban in order to force the Russians, the Soviets out, and now the Russians may be supporting the Taliban in order to keep us bogged down and to inflict another loss on us, much like they are able to do in Syria.
It's interesting you brought up the word eradication, because not only are you the professor of political science here at USD, I think you're a magician, because that word was right here. Yeah. So it's almost like you pulled it out of my frontal lobe to talk about it. And we may touch on that again.
Yeah, the powers I have, they're usually secret. But
now, as far as Afghanistan is concerned, does Mr. Trump really only have two options here, to engage or not engage, or is there more to this story?
Well, there probably is more, but we do have to say that he was not dealt the best possible hand on Afghanistan. And what we oftentimes discover is that American foreign policy is based more on inertia than momentum. And the inertia is that once in, it's really difficult to leave. Mm-hmm. And so I think he's essentially taking the default position that so many presidents and so many American presidents toward so many other countries have taken. And I think that, he's hoping that eventually the United States can withdraw from Afghanistan with some modicum of dignity and integrity. But we oftentimes frame things in the United States where it's either or, it's option A or option B. And really, he could have a number of options. One is simply to pull up stakes and get out. We've been there for over a decade and a half now. Another is to keep the force level exactly where it is. But that's not going to succeed. That's not going to accomplish anything. Third, you go with an insertion of additional forces so that even if, practically speaking, it doesn't accomplish anything, politically and public relations-wise, it looks like you're renewing the commitment and you're taking steps. Now, if we really wanted to defeat the Taliban and to prevent ISIS from gaining any larger foothold in Afghanistan, then it would take a remarkable surge of forces. Tens of thousands of troops would have to help spread the Afghan state's reach throughout a significant part, probably a majority of Afghanistan that it doesn't control. It would also require us to call Pakistan to task. And if what I mentioned earlier appears to be especially true, and that is the response of the Russians, it means that we would also have to challenge the Russians and their insertion of influence again in Afghanistan. So there would be more options, but all of the options that would want to accomplish what President Trump wants to accomplish, and that's the defeat of the Taliban, defeat of ISIS, that's going to cost us significantly more, and probably a price that the American people and the American Congress are unwilling to pay.
Chapter one of our conversation is over, so we're going to move on since you've touched on it. ISIS. For those that don't know, what does ISIS stand for?
It is, and there are various translations, but it is essentially the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The creation of a government and then the creation of a country that is rooted in a very austere and kind of radically conservative form of Islam. And it is a religious political ideology that harkens back to the early days of Islam. And the founders of the Islamic State, Muhammad al, I just forgot his name. That's what I get for trying to use the name. He looks and says, any other state that purports to be Islamic on the stage today is not. That they have turned their back on God. They have turned their back on the Quran. We are going to build it the way it needs to be built.
So real quickly, you mentioned ISIS. And when Mr. Obama was in office, he referred to ISIL.
Correct.
So in a nutshell, are they the same? Are they different?
They are the same. And essentially, ISIL is the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which is an older term that encompasses Syria, Lebanon, perhaps even parts of northern Israel into Jordan, and then right up to and into Iraq then.
So depending on who you talk to, if you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Shorn from the University of South Dakota on In the Moment. ISIS is on the run. Is there any truth to that?
Yes and no. They are moving. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. By golly, I knew I would think of the name of the leader of ISIS, and it was better now than at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
But
because I would have got the phone call.
Yeah, absolutely. and they are... They're on the move. They are not closing up shop. They're moving the shop. And the problem is if we look at it, they're kind of closing down the big box store and recreating little neighborhood corner markets. They are, and I think most of them see the handwriting on the wall. Most of the leadership who is still alive, a lot of the fighters realize that ultimately they are going, more than likely going to lose in Iraq and Syria. But that means that, again, they're just going to be moving, and it's going to be the spreading of elements of ISIS to significant portions of the world, which makes it a lot more difficult then ultimately to defeat them.
I'm about 99% sure I'm going to answer my own question.
Right.
And you talked about it earlier. You pulled that word out of my head.
Yep.
Is there ever a chance that ISIS is going to be eradicated?
No, not to the point where, they don't exist at all. Now, they may morph into something else so that it could be in 5 years we don't hear the word ISIS anymore or the term ISIS anymore. What we will hear instead is, for example, we move from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. Now, Al-Qaeda still exists, but ISIS came out of people who felt Al-Qaeda wasn't moving forward quickly enough and perhaps wasn't radical enough. So what could happen is that ISIS as a brand, as an organization, will cease to be, but a lot of the people who are part of ISIS are simply going to set up their own little organizations elsewhere in the world. And that could be that it'll be less of a universalist ideology and universalist approach, and it'll start being more kind of regional or focused on particular regions or even within particular countries. So it could be that, the name ISIS might be eradicated. The organization, the philosophy, the goals will be with us for decades to come or longer.
Now, real quick, this is an easy question. Does this group need extensive focus, constant attention, or can we just leave them alone and just let them do what they want to do? That wouldn't be smart, I don't think.
No, and we face a couple of problems, and we did this with Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. When you focus on a particular group and talk about them all the time, you do end up empowering them, and you give them more kind of intangible power than the tangible power they already held. So when we started blaming Al-Qaeda for everything and Osama bin Laden for everything from the 1990s on, all of a sudden they became bigger than they really were, and people thought, who might have been drawn to them said, well, hey, if America, the great Satan, thinks Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden are so bad, then they must be doing something right and we should join them. And a little bit of the same thing happened with ISIS. But the problem is we can't let sleeping dogs lie, because they're going to be up to something somewhere. And I mean, I would list a half a dozen countries where I expect the remnants of ISIS, whether we're paying attention to them or not, are going to start causing discontent, start fomenting violence, carrying out terrorist attacks, and then ultimately lead to a completely uncivil society and deteriorated stability and security elsewhere.
Chapter two of this conversation is over.
All right.
North Korea.
Well, there's nothing much to say there.
The latest is North Korea's first successful ballistic missile launch over Japan. What do you make of that?
Well, it's not a surprise. It shouldn't be a surprise to anyone who's been watching. We know that they've been trying to get that technology. I mean, certainly one of the questions that policymakers and think tanks are thinking about is, one, where does North Korea get this technology? It's not all indigenous to North Korea. They must be acquiring it somewhere, which means that while we're focusing on North Korea and whatever they're doing with nuclear weapons and missile technology, we also have to find a way to shut down the pipeline that is allowing this type of technology to be shared around the world. Now, we get very nervous when they start firing ICBMs that have the ability eventually to reach American territory. What we have to keep in mind is that while our crisis today is something that South Korea and Japan and North Korea's neighbors have been living with for decades, and that is an unpredictable, aggressive, envelope-pushing North Korean government, that South Korea has since the end of the Korean War, has lived under the threat of North Korean armaments. And it can be, you know, it doesn't have to be a nuclear device. North Korea has enough artillery to rain literal hell down on Seoul and parts of South Korea within minutes. So South Korea has been living with this threat for 65 years. Japan has been living under certain threats. So the fact that we're getting especially concerned about the ICBM means that we probably haven't been paying attention to the threats that our friends have been living under for decades. Now, that's not to say that I approve of North Korea getting ICBM ballistic missile technology, nor am I particularly excited about their ability to turn their nuclear warheads into a next generation of warhead that can successfully sit atop a ballistic missile. But I think we need to keep things in context, and we have to understand that others have been living with this threat, and if not being able to contain it, have been able to live with it without turning a small crisis into an even larger crisis and conflagration.
Just to clarify, you referenced ICBM. That's intercontinental ballistic missile for those that don't know.
Right.
In the short amount of time we have left, like a minute left, and I've got a lot of thoughts, and we'll have you back.
Sounds good.
Why do you suppose that North Korea has chosen to advance its missile and nuclear weapons program now?
And I think that it's not so much a decision now, it's what they're capable of at any given point, that they have been able to start putting all the pieces together, that they find suppliers, that you make an advance and you keep testing it, and if the parts and pieces are coming together. And I think that they're always pushing forward. And the question is, when are they able to successfully take that next step? And that's what we're watching now.
Dr. Tim Shorn is professor of political science at the University of South Dakota. Dr. Shorn, thanks as always for your time and knowledge. We really appreciate it.
And I enjoy coming over here. I look forward to coming back.